And good morning. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday. I'm Connor Thomas filling in for Leslie Thatcher. Going to start you off with the weather. It's 45 degrees here in Park City. A nice layer of fog over the Swanner Eco Preserve this morning. And on the phone with more about the Wasatch Back's outlook on the weather, ABC4 meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Wasatch Back, Park City. Yeah, we've got a pretty nice forecast shaping up this morning. Some changes, though, moving back in this afternoon. So following some overnight showers and storms, we are going to see smoke fill in behind the storm system to the north of us that's exiting out. It usually draws down a northwest flow, and we've got some big fires in Idaho that's going to contribute some smoke and haze to northern Utah. So highs today, pretty comfortable, 74 for Park City, 82 in Heber. Haze still sticking around for Thursday, overnight lows in the 40s, highs in the upper 70s for Park City tomorrow, back in the 80s on Friday, Saturday, sunshine taking over. High pressure will help transition that northwest flow to more of a westerly flow that should help nudge a lot of the smoke and haze to the east of us, should improve our air quality some into the weekend. And then into next week, kind of more of the same, what we've been seeing with high pressure to the southeast of us. Monsoon moisture will get swept back up into our area. We're expecting partly cloudy skies and a chance of storms Sunday into Monday next week for Park City. Temperatures near 80 degrees for highs, overnight lows in the mid-50s. Sunny on Tuesday, slight chance of a storm still lingering in the higher terrain with upper 70s on Tuesday with mid-50s for overnight lows. Heber looking at mid-80s returning tomorrow, near 90 degrees for the end of the week, 88 on Friday and on Saturday. Plan on plenty of sunshine. Gorgeous kickoff to the weekend. Increasing cloud cover on Sunday, mid-80s into next week as well, with a chance of storms on Sunday and Monday. Might see a stray shower on Tuesday. Temperatures still in the mid-80s, so closer to seasonal averages by early next week.
Nate Larson, thank you so much.
You bet.
And we'll be keeping an eye on the traffic throughout the hour. I'm looking at UDOT's map and not seeing any reported accidents right now. If you do see anything, you can call in or text at 435-655-8255. But as per usual, that eastbound 80 exit onto US 40 east slash southbound is beginning to back up. That's the usual for the morning commute right now. So plan extra time if you're headed that way. And coming up in the hour, we'll be speaking with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes about development projects throughout the county. Then Deputy Park City Manager Sarah Pierce previews this week's City Council meeting. That's tomorrow. And then the Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Nadel, and their Youth Education Director, Erica Snyder, have an update on the garden there in Silver Springs. That's all coming up. And then at 9 a.m., it's the Mountain Life. In this rebroadcast episode, the guests include journalist and author Christy Oshwandan, who talks about MHO, or metabolically healthy obesity, in her recent Scientific American article, People Who Are Fat and Healthy May Hold Keys to Understanding Obesity, and ultra runner Charlie McKee, who in 9 months and 21 days summited all 162 named peaks with public access in Salt Lake County. That consisting of mostly big weekend adventures, a lot of alpine starts, and many late evenings. Talks about that experience. That's on the Mountain Life at 9 a.m. after the local news hour. Then get ready for the thrill of Friday Night Football on KPCW this Friday at 7 p.m. Park City Miners are taking on the Hillcrest Huskies from Midvale at home on Dozier Field. The Miners fresh off a dominant 42-0 victory over Dixie and riding an undefeated season so far, are set for an epic showdown with Hillcrest. Plus, we'll keep you updated on all the local action from the Wasatch, North Summit, and South Summit games. Whether you're at the game or tuning in from home, our broadcast team will bring you every exciting play. Don't miss that. It's at 7 p.m. this Friday here on KPCW. Getting into a little bit of local news now, there are some opening dates to report from Utah ski resorts. Brian Head will be the first ski area to open in Utah this season. That's on November 8th. Park City Mountain announced its November 22nd opening date last month, and Alta is scheduled to open the same day. Near Ogden, Snow Basin opens November 29th. Nordic Valley is December 7th. Deer Valley recently announced 100 days until its opening day, December 2nd. Sundance Mountain Resort also opens December 2nd. In central Utah near Beaver, Eagle Point Resort is scheduled to open December 20th. That's the latest opening date announced so far. Many resorts have not confirmed opening dates for the upcoming winter season, including Woodward Park City, Beaver Mountain, Brighton, Cherry Peak, Powder Mountain, Snowbird, and Solitude. All opening dates are weather dependent, of course, and subject to change. And Park City's established a new committee to make recommendations for nonprofit funding. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports the city is now accepting applications.
The Nonprofit Services Advisory Committee was established by the City Council in August to play a vital role in determining how Park City funds support local nonprofits. Committee members can be Park City residents, workers, volunteers, property owners, or business owners. Any employee or board member of a nonprofit likely to apply for grant funding from the city is not allowed to sit on the committee under the rules approved by the City Council. Committee members are expected to serve 3-year terms and attend up to 4 meetings annually. Once the committee is established, members will create guidelines, evaluate and interview grant applicants, and make funding recommendations to the City Council. The council has final approval over nonprofit funding. The city is accepting applications to be a member of the committee until September 13th. A link to apply can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The local nonprofit Save People, Save Wildlife has added 2 sets of animal silhouette statues to the collection on State Route 224. The 2 moose calves are now on the right side of the road going toward Park City before Cutter Lane. President of Save People, Save Wildlife, Aaron Ferguson, says the statues commemorate the loss of the mother moose in September 2023 that left her 2 calves orphaned. Ferguson says the nonprofit also placed 2 deer silhouettes by Silver Springs Pond on the east side of the highway. They can be seen by drivers headed out of town. Installed Thursday and paid for by the organization's donors, the additions increase the total number of reflective statues to 10 on the corridor. The statues first appeared on 224 last year after Save People, Save Wildlife donated a pair of elk silhouettes to the city. The 9-foot-tall elk are designed to show the animal's shape and remind drivers that aerial wildlife may be crossing the road. Around the same time, 2 deer statues were installed near the Swanner Eco Preserve. A few months later, the Animal Advocacy Group installed 2 reflective moose at the intersection of Cutter and 224 as well. On the phone with me from Summit County's Planning Department is Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Connor. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you. So any new applications to report there at the county?
Well, I'd like to say everything's quiet and we all have our feet upon the desk and are drinking coffee, looking forward to some excitement. But the truth is, no, we've actually got quite a bit going on. There's existing applications, obviously, some fairly complex ones that are being looked into on a daily basis with, you know, tremendous amount of work being done by my very hardworking team. But also some new ones coming up. The exciting ones, which we're still reviewing the actual application itself, so we're not actually timetabled any meetings before the Planning Commission yet. But over on the east side, the Blue Sky Ranch is going to be returning to the Planning Commission eventually with a proposal for a 72-lot residential subdivision. It's actually providing homes as part of an extension to the Blue Sky Hotel, which will be run and managed through the hotel project. That will actually involve a rezone of property from AG 80 to AG 10. There was a project reviewed early in this process by the Planning Commission. They've went away, they've redesigned some things, coming back with some modifications to the plans and the infrastructure, and we'll be returning as soon as we've done our level of appropriate analysis. Another interesting one, which you may or may not be excited about, is the phase 2 of the workforce housing at the Canyons Village Housing, where the proposal to actually accelerate the phase 2 of the workforce housing project over there for 147 new units to add to the workforce housing stock. Again, that's under review and will be returning to the appropriate reviewing authorities. And another exciting one, which is probably a sign of the times, we did actually receive an application from the UOP, the Utah Olympic Park, for a 120-room hotel. that application again, currently under review to make sure they've dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's, doing a comparison with the existing development agreements. But that looks like a sign of things to come, the larger, more complex projects and those that may or may not be influenced by upcoming future events in the Olympics.
Yeah.
Those and obviously the traditional handful of smaller projects, the standard plan amendments, the small extensions, you know, small subdivisions, which we hope are less controversial, but surprisingly enough, lately, some of those latest decisions by the various planning commissions have resulted in appeals, and we actually have one of those at the planning at the council tonight.
Yeah, and I'm curious about the phase two of that workforce housing and canyons you mentioned. Is that going to be going in the existing sort of slopeside area, an add-on to that building?
Yes, essentially, yes. It's a further development of the similar project to the extent that people think there's a dramatic, you know, new project being developed in a different location. The answer is no. Actually, phase two of that slopes project, we actually view it as what we call an amendment to a final site plan. So the original site plan anticipated this. The original proposal anticipated this. So this is actually, because of the success and popularity of the original one, this has actually probably just accelerated the process for us.
Yeah, more than 1,000 units or beds already there. Are there any more phases after phase two that are anticipated under that entitlement?
I don't believe so under that particular application, but the Canyons itself obviously is an ongoing development, and there's a substantial amount still to be done. And so we are actually looking at some rather more complex applications coming in the remainder of the canyons, not actually in the workforce housing section, but above and beyond that in the rest of the development.
All right. I want to ask about last week's county council meeting. You've been having more joint meetings between the planning commissions on the east and west side and the county council. This one was with the east side planning commission. One of the things you showed at the beginning was this map you're creating maps around the county of developed and undeveloped land. Could you kind of describe those efforts and where you're at with it?
I'd like to make it clear, and I will, you know, if everyone can see this map over the radio, which is going to be a little bit awkward, but these maps will be published. What we're actually doing, people constantly, you know, refer to statistics, you know, how much land is developed, how much land is left to be developed. The last time we produced any maps was, you know, probably, you know, a good 5, 6, 7 years ago, pre-COVID definitely, probably when we last did the general plan updates. As part of the ongoing general plan creations for the new general plans, which this whole process will run for next year, we're actually digging deeper into our statistics and creating more maps that were relevant to people. The map I actually had on display was a parcel map of the east side of the county. We have a similar one for the basin side of the county. And it's what it actually shows is existing parcels that actually have development on, or parcels that are proposed to be developed but have yet to be built. Some of this information is extracted from assessor data, some of it is just from records, and together with the statistics regarding unit counts, because obviously there are some parcels that from the assessor's perspective have no value, which might mean, for example, someone might just assume that nothing's developed on it, but the truth is that might be a parcel that's owned by a tax exempt entity such as the county itself and actually has a development on it. So there's a degree of investigation. Once you got some statistics, you need to go a little bit further. But in terms of comparing the map colors, what we, you know, would call it like a heat map, a concentration of colors, is actually a good indication of not what the absolute number is, but how development changes over time. So you can do a comparison between the map we're creating now and the maps that have been done previously to see, well, you know, where the excitement and interest is in development and where, you know, future development is likely to occur. These maps will become a series of maps that we've been able to lay our hands on information, but we've not really had mapping capability in the past with regard to our general plan. So part of the new updates to the plans is creating a much higher degree of sophistication in our mapping. So different maps, different availability to people, and a lot of these maps will just be publicly available on our website. And that's the hope eventually, they will actually become interactive and usable maps.
Yeah, because I'd hazard a guess that most people, myself included, assume that the Snyderville Basin side of things is mostly built out or already entitled, and there's more uncertainty on the east side, potentially growing entitlements there. Is that what you're finding in the maps, or are you upsetting some of those assumptions?
Not really. It's obviously fairly easy to draw that conclusion that, you know, the basin's full, so let's everybody move over to the east. The truth is that the last time we did a wholesale rezone of the east side, where we actually changed the maps on the east side, we reduced the highest density, for example, that can be obtained in a units per acre basis on the east side is 1 unit per 5 acres. And the Snyderville Basin side, the base density is 1 unit per 20 acres. If you think about that, the east side has 4 times the allowable density as the basin. But that in itself is a fairly misleading statistic. The reason what's preventing a wholesale development on the east side is the lack of infrastructure. You know, we don't have, you know, adequate and accessible roads. We don't have water infrastructure. We don't have sewer infrastructure, wastewater infrastructure. So those things actually make it much more difficult to physically develop on the east side. But obviously, let's, you know, not forget we have the giant project in terms of attention seeking, not in terms of its actual size, is the Cedar Crest project near Hoytsville, which the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission has been looking at for almost 2 years now. Prior to that, we had a subcommittee reviewing that, and it's still in a stage of flux. I don't actually see that coming back to the Planning Commission for another few weeks at least, and those applicants will be looking to move it up to council as soon as possible. But whether that actually happens before the end of the year, I don't really know. The basin side, what we're looking at now is more redevelopment of existing developed areas, such as the outlet mall. If people have heard about that project, there's projects over at Silver Summit and in Silver Springs where people are looking at either some previously developed or undeveloped land next to adjacent developed land with a view to potential rezones.
Yeah, and you mentioned the somewhat more allowed density on the east side. Another thing that came out of that conversation last week between the east side planners and council were some reservations about the allowed uses on the east side. It sounds like it's a little more permissive, if that's the right word, whereas the Snyderville Basin's code gets a lot more restrictive as to which, you know, things can be built in which particular zone. It sounds like a lot is allowed in every single zone that exists on the east side. Is there an appetite to change that from Planning Commission?
I think you read the tone of the Planning Commission correctly. The east side traditionally has been more permissive in terms of property rights. You know, it's like, I have my piece of land. What's the government? Why is the government trying to interfere with what I want to do? Obviously, there was a lot less ambition, and some of these property rights, you know, may have been, for example, you know, if someone drives their landscaping truck home and they park their truck outside their house, and then they park another truck outside their house, and then they park, and then they have a worker come to borrow their vehicle, and, you know, suddenly, do we have a home-based business or do we have a contractor's yard? And previously, that's been less controversial because people have been more disturbed. You know, the actions you take on your property have less likely impact on your neighbor if you're separated, you know, by, you know, a quarter of a mile, half a mile, and a mile apart on large lot subdivisions. But now, as in, you know, development has intensified on the east side, and there's a realization that, do we want something that would be considered a nuisance elsewhere in a pure, what people have seen as a purely residential subdivision? So there's a recognition that with growth come growing pains, and perhaps it's time to take another look at the use table, what may be allowed, what may be conditionally allowed, what may be low impact permit allowed, and what actually may be more appropriate place somewhere else, in which case that might involve some rezoning. And rezoning is a difficult and complex exercise and fraught with emotion. So we actually see some entertaining meetings in our future.
Yeah, and you know, the most visible example of this that you did mention is that Cedar Crest proposal. This, for people who don't know, is a proposed primarily residential development in the Hoytsville area, which phased in over many, many years, could, you know, turn the area into something that looks like a pretty well-established town. You know, I haven't seen this on an agenda recently. Is there work going on in the background? Any updates that you can share about when the next meeting might be?
There is. It's not been the level of intensity that we would like as planning staff. To the extent that we were at the Planning Commission several months ago now, and the public have been involved and definitely engaged in a very appropriate and meaningful way. And their comments and reflections that have, you know, bounced back off the Planning Commission and comments to the, you know, the property owners, the development team associated with our project. The development team actually, you know, kind of went away and said, maybe we need to rethink some of the things we're asking for, some of the proposals that we're making, because there's a lot of unanswered questions in what is essentially a plan to develop a plan. It's the implementation strategies. What might this look like 20 or 30 years from now? We don't know, but what can we predict 5 years out, 10 years out, 15 years out? What is the appropriate level of development that people either want to see? Does it uphold the current community values, those values that we've been promoting through this entire process? This is a very, very significant project, and people quite rightly wary of it and are asking appropriate questions. The confusion and probably somewhat disappointment at the Planning Commission level is that some of the more direct questions they were asking, the developer was either reluctant to answer or unable to answer because of the future unknowns. So they actually undertook to go away and see how they could drill down and reanalyze their projects and come back with more appropriate information. Staff have met with them less than a handful of times in the last few months and had several meetings said, you know, you probably need more detail on this question, that question. Probably, you know, the one that comes up most often is the traffic study and the affordability component. And what is actually really being proposed in terms of density, and not what is being asked for, but what might be achievable on the lots. And, you know, we've had some inconclusive meetings. The last one we had was literally 10 days ago, and the applicant thought they were prepared. We asked them a few questions. They went away to rethink. They were hoping to be at the Planning Commission at the next meeting, but it has not come to pass. Maybe the one after that, the one after that. We deliberately took them clean off the agenda. So instead of being this as a, you know, to a future certain date, we undertook to hold everything, and we will completely re-notice a new public hearing when the appropriate level of information comes into play. So it's I don't think it's out of hand, but it got seriously complex and very nuanced in the discussion. I think Planning Commission and the applicant and the public are all frustrated, and if we can maintain that level of frustration and a manageable standpoint, maybe next time they come back, we'll actually have some answers.
All right. And just a final question. One redevelopment item on the west side is at Junction Commons, formerly Outlets Park City. What any updates to offer on that? That's been going through multiple work sessions at the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission.
And more to come. In terms of summary, the numbers are big. For those people who don't know but may know the Factory Stores, has the what we call the lower loop of commercial area and the upper loop of commercial area. The current proposal on the table is a proposal to rezone from the current town center zoning under the development agreement to what we call the neighborhood mixed use zone. And as a mixed use, as that implies, it's not just single-story commercial strip mall development with large parking areas, but actually involves the redevelopment of some of those buildings to add, remove some of the commercial element, add housing, infill some of the parking area with some mixed-use opportunities, create a much more walkable, genuine mixed-use, high-density development. The numbers involved, not staggering in the urban design realm, but might be, you know, intriguing to members of the public who are listening. The current proposal is to essentially remove about 85,000 square feet of the commercial area on the upper loop and replace that with what they're currently asking for is about 308 residential units, of which 105 are currently proposed to be deed-restricted affordable units. There's also a proposal to add a mixed-use component in the parking lot in the lower loop, which would be adding about 70 to 75,000 square feet of commercial with some residential over the top. So it's a very significant development in terms of its complexity. It would be done over many years. I'd like to say that the Planning Commission are intrigued, but there's going to be plenty of work sessions in our future as we drill down on the details and find out what's actually necessary to achieve that and what's actually achievable in practical terms.
And that's, I think, all we have time for. We've been speaking with Community Development Director Peter Barnes at Summit County. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Connor.
This is KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie this morning. And here with me in the studio is Sarah Pierce. She's the Deputy Park City Manager with a preview of tomorrow's City Council meeting. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Maybe we can begin with the discussion of ranked choice voting that's scheduled tomorrow. I gather the city did a survey about how many people responded and what did you learn from it?
You know, there's been some interest in us looking at ranked choice voting, and we talked to council earlier in the year about it. And at that point we said, oh, let's do a little bit of outreach and see what the community thinks. And so we decided to create a mock election so that people could give it a try. And then we did a survey. You know, once you got through the election, mock election, you could then choose to do a survey. And unfortunately, we didn't get a lot of participation. But we did get some good comments in those survey results. I think we got about 100 people participating. So we thought it was worth bringing back to council just to close the loop to see if they're still interested in it. We are going to have Utah ranked choice voting organization representatives come to the council meeting to talk through a little bit more about what they've learned since the last time they were visiting council. And just, you know, have more conversation with council and see if they're interested in pursuing it.
If they are interested, how do you do that? What's the process?
So if they are interested, then we would need to officially conduct a resolution, have a public hearing, and then we would need to file with the Lieutenant Governor's office and then get that started for next year.
Gotcha. What would be the deadline that you'd have to decide by?
I think the deadline to submit to the Lieutenant Governor is next spring, so we have a bit of time.
All right. And there will also be a presentation the council will hear on different public financing tools. These are different ways, I guess, to raise the capital needed for types of development or redevelopment. Is there particular areas or projects the council has its eye on that it could apply some of these tools to?
I don't think quite yet. I mean, you can use these tools for things like public infrastructure and housing projects, which obviously we have plenty of those in the pipeline. This is a great opportunity to hear from the professionals at Gilmore Bell, our bond and finance council, to really review all the various options that there are. And the legislature has actually recently expanded the options, and they're all new to everyone. So it'll be a great opportunity to hear more about what those offer.
Any particular interesting ones that are new to everyone? I mean, it's a lot of words in that agenda, any interesting ones to flag for folks?
You know, I think there are some really interesting ones around affordable housing, which I think will be key as we move forward on that challenge that we're trying to solve. So I think that'll be of a lot of interest to people.
A lot of home ownership ones, a lot of the affordable housing projects we're pursuing in town seem rental focused. Are there issues applying those, you think?
I am not an expert in this area, and that's why we're bringing Gilmore Bell in tomorrow night. So I'm going to refrain from trying to answer that one.
Fair enough. One thing that could be scheduled for approval tomorrow is the Main Street Waterline project.
Yes.
The HPCA, which represents some of the Main Street businesses, actually asked for the schedule to be accelerated. What did you hear from them? Why are they asking for a faster timeline?
Well, it is certainly impactful, as you saw this summer, or this spring, I should say. And we want to get through it as least impactful as possible. And so working with the HPCA, we brainstormed some different options. And one of them was to do some work this fall when things slow down a bit and try to, you know, get some things done so that next spring the work wouldn't be so impactful. So that's the plan. Should council move forward with this contract, there would be some tearing up of the street from 5th to the top of Main, where it meets Sweet Alley, and all the work would be in the street. And the next spring, the tie off from the main lines to the individual businesses would happen, and hopefully we can, you know, get that done quicker.
And, you know, does the city have to abide by that October 15th, I think, is the deadline for road work? Because then the weather does turn. Do you have to abide by that deadline?
We're looking to kind of see if we can maneuver around that a bit just to try to get this done for the businesses. So.
If you do accelerate the timeline, when would the third phase be? Does that get moved up to next spring?
We're still looking at likely doing some work in spring of 26, but it would be less because we're moving forward a little bit quicker.
All right. Moving on to Main Street area plan. This is more of a long-term visioning thing. Nothing, I guess, to approve or deny here, or am I wrong about that?
No, you're right about that. We kind of committed to a very transparent, although fast-tracked process. So we just continue to come back to council with a recap of each of the committee meetings, and this is one of those recaps.
And, you know, the ideas get as, you know, I don't want to say crazy, but, you know, it's big stuff like gondolas and just different types of transportation. Any next steps, like actionable things that could come out of this visioning process?
Oh, I definitely think so. You know, the council wanted to kind of look at this in a bit of a different way. They set some critical targets, and then they asked consultants to provide some options around those targets. And then we brought on this citizens advisory group to kind of further push those options to a place that maybe the public could react to. So we're getting close to that. We're looking at likely a public engagement opportunity in the fall where they could really see the different ideas, you know. A lot of them are bold and innovative, and why not throw all those out there and see what sticks?
Yeah, I'm more familiar with this process on the county level where, you know, visioning process informs general plan, which informs code, which then is actually the thing that's binding. Is it a similar structure at the city level? How could these visioning ideas trickle down into something more binding?
Well, I think, you know, once we hone in on some ideas that everyone feels good about, then there'll be a process for, you know, if codes need to be changed, if, you know, we need to look at different building structures, all of that would go through that similar process.
All right. And one other thing on the agenda, China Bridge Garage, you know, is safe, but potentially could be unsafe in the next decade or so if it is not repaired. So the council is looking at doing that. Is this the item to authorize repairs? Where's the council at on that?
Yeah, this is actually a report on the assessment. We contracted a Kimberly Horn to do this assessment, and we found that the retaining wall along Marsac had some significant issues, and so that wall really needs to be replaced. The southern half of the parking structure was built in 1986. And it's overall in fair condition, but the consultant recommended some significant maintenance and repairs for some of the more degraded structural elements. The northern half is actually in better shape. It was built in 2006, so we're not looking for any significant near-term repairs required for that.
So no impacts, and of course, still safe to park.
Correct.
This is not on the agenda, but I wanted to throw in one last question about Sundance. I know you used to work there, and they did recently tour Park City. As they're looking, considering just lots of different options around the country for 2027 and beyond. Why tour Park City? I feel like they know us very well at this point. What did we tell them that was new this time?
Well, actually, they did not tour Park City. They had one day. Each city got one day. And Sundance was like, hey, we're really familiar with Park City. And, you know, we submitted a collaborative bid with Park City and Salt Lake in the mix, and they've voiced their interest in expanding more in Salt Lake. And so we thought we'd spend the day really looking at Salt Lake because they don't know it as well. Most of the leadership of Sundance just comes straight up to Park City during the festival, and you know, they know it. So we had a really fantastic day in Salt Lake. I actually live down there, and I learned some new things about the city that I live in. There's a lot of really cool venues that have been built in the, you know, recent years, restaurants, bars, et cetera. And I think Sundance got a really good taste of what that could look like, while still keeping a really good presence in Park City. So we're looking forward to the next steps in the process.
All right. That's it as far as council previewing. Is there anything else you want to add, flag for the public about the meeting tomorrow?
I don't think so. I just encourage everybody to come in and participate, especially if you're interested in ranked choice voting. We'd love to hear from the public about that.
For sure. Voter turnout, very important. And we've been speaking with Deputy City Manager Sarah Pierce about tomorrow's Park City Council meeting. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie this morning. And here with me in the studio now is Helen Nadel and Erica Snyder. They're from Summit Community Gardens and Eats, both. They've got an update on the gardens. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us, Connor.
You bet. Maybe we can begin with you, Erica. You've got summer camps every year.
Yes.
How did it go this year? Kind of describe what you offer.
Oh, our summer camps went great. We have we run 16 weeks of camps. We do 8 pre-K camps and 8 elementary camps. Each camp has its own theme, like arts in the garden or a week in the life of a gardener, budding culinary scientists. And, you know, we're just really proud of how well they were attended and how many scholarships we were able to offer this year.
Cool. And, you know, school started 2 weeks ago now, I think, you know, in full swing. What are you offering already and any things coming up for people to sign up for?
So we have consistently Fridays, we have a cooking class that alternates through the 4 elementary schools, Curious Cooks. We also have Parley's Park Elementary has a greenhouse, and so programming starts there next week. And then we also have our own after-school program in the garden. That's on Mondays, Fridays, and then either Wednesday or Thursday. We're feeling that out a little bit. And so that'll be kind of the culmination of all the work that the spring program did and putting the seeds in the ground and taking care of the garden as the summer campers did, pulling weeds and replanting some stuff that needed replanted. And it'll be harvest time. So I always tell people, like, this is the best time to come to a garden. If you haven't been to a garden, join in fall.
Yeah, you have a super seasonal thing going on with, you know, the snow. It's difficult to garden in that. So
yes.
Do you have programs that continue throughout the school year ahead of the spring as well?
Not specifically at the garden. Our after school in the garden will run through the end of October. And then we are in the schools. We are in the middle schools through YSA. We have a Think Globally, Eat Locally is our theme this year. And so that's really fun to cook a little more sophisticated recipes with the older kids. And then we also, we go into preschools with Holy Cross Ministries and PC Tots, and that series focuses on Eat the Rainbow. So we keep it just really simple for the littles. We keep it about colors and just trying to get them to recognize how eating a colorful palette is good for their bodies.
And Helen, Erica mentioned it's harvest is this month. What are you expecting to reap, I guess.
Oh my goodness. Well, thanks, Connor, again for having us on. I'm super excited to share that. You know, this is actually the biggest harvest time for Summit Community Gardens. We have already harvested about 650 pounds of food that goes directly to patients at the People's Health Clinic through our partnership called Food Pharmacy with Christian Center. And that food is abundant. We've gotten, so much, like onions, zucchini, lots of greens. We're starting with tomatoes. And once the tomatoes happen, it is a very exciting time. This is actually the most robust month for harvests. So really looking for, you know, just lots of food to be heading towards the food pantry. And we've got, you know, our staff is growing a ton of food, but we've also got a lot of volunteers who are part of our plot runner community who are so committed to the idea of community and of making sure that people in our community have the fresh food that they need to be healthy. They're actually growing in their own plots. They've gotten an extra plot. They are growing there. So they're helping us raise a lot of food.
650 pounds this year or ever?
Sorry.
Like,
so last,
how much food is that?
Yes,
like,
Connor.
It's hard to visualize.
Let's fill you in a little bit. Okay. Yeah. So we've got last year we raised 1,300 pounds of food for the food pharmacy. So this year to date. You know, our harvest really started. We started getting food in our high altitude growing season in mid-June is when we started harvesting some of those early season crops like radishes and greens. And we've been harvesting through July and August. And now it's really, it's all go. Tons of food being harvested. So we're looking to meet or exceed that 1,300 pounds of food again this year.
All right.
Yeah.
And you are about a week and a day away from the Farm to Fork event. Could you describe this for folks who don't know and how they can find tickets?
Yeah, of course. So this is the second year of Farm to Fork, a combined fundraiser with Summit Community Gardens and Eats. And we are really excited to be able to share this event with the community. Park City Pendry has really graciously donated so much to allow us to be up there on the roof deck with fabulous food, a stunning view. We're going to have a couple of signature cocktails from the garden. We've got a mint mojito and lavender simple syrup cocktail. We'll be harvesting those herbs next week and bringing them up to the Pendry. And we are really looking, honestly, to just have a wonderful time in celebration of all the work that we do and of all of our supporters. I really felt strongly that I wanted to have, you know, obviously it's an event in support of our work, but I also really wanted to have a great time and to celebrate with our community. So what we're going to be doing is having just a really short live auction. I'm going to throw out some exciting options that we've got there. They're all food-focused experiences. They're all unique, one-of-a-kind, kind of homespun. We're not going to be giving any trips to Puerto Vallarta, but instead we're going to be doing things like having Miss Erica and Miss Brady have a birthday party offering for, you know, 10 kids in your home to have a seed-to-plate experience where kids can prepare all the treats and snacks for the birthday party, kind of allows a parent to sit back and relax. We've got some wonderful dinner party experiences led by me and Miss Brady. This is something I've done a lot in other nonprofits that I've worked for, where we have a really fabulous custom designed dinner party in people's homes. We've got some cocktails on offer with a special star mixologist. And we've also got a wonderful experience up on Main Street at Mountaintown Olive Oil with Susan O'Dell, who is an incredible partner for us. She's a founder of Eats, and she's really been supporting this event. She's going to be doing a cooking class. She is really a cooking class guru. She's going to be leading a class with a wine pairing up at Mountaintown Olive Oil. And then our final kind of experience is that our great garden director, Melissa Soltes, is going to be leading an experience for anybody who wants to get into the garden, become more expert. And we're going to give away a garden plot, tons of garden classes, consulting hours with her so that you can really plan the garden of your dreams. I'm also just going to mention that my partner in making this a short, sweet, and successful live auction experience is Diego Zagara, who is making his debut as an auctioneer. He is, although it's his first time, he has been studying with the experts and is really, I think, going to make it a fabulous, fun, snappy event. We're excited to bring everybody together. And again, it's about it's about celebrating the work that we do and having a ton of fun together up there at the Pendry. So please go on our website, www.summitcommunitygardens.org, buy yourself a ticket, or you can also go onto Instagram, which is @summitcommunitygardens, and you can just check out the link in the bio. We are super excited to welcome everybody there.
All right. And, you know, I also want to take a step back because I drive by the garden all the time. Not everyone does, and you might be unfamiliar to some listeners. Could you introduce kind of where you are and how folks can maybe get a plot? I know there's frequently a wait list, though. Just how people can get involved if they don't know you yet.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. So the garden, you can just sort of take a peek at it if you're driving up 224. The Summit Community Garden is located on Summit County land. It's in the same complex as Matt Noop, park, some great open space. That land was provided to the county under a conservation easement that it be used for recreation, open space, and agriculture. And we are there. We are. You can open up that gate. You can walk around, take a breath of fresh air. You can join us under the sail shades, generously provided by Recreation Wrap Tax of Summit County. And really, everyone is welcome to enjoy that space.
Right.
We do have, I'm going to mention, we do have, you asked about plot rentals. We do have our 2025 sign up ready. Please go on the website and sign up onto the wait list. We usually do get, this year we got everybody off the wait list. So please go ahead and sign up, and we'll be back in touch later in the fall to sign you up.
All right. And any other events that you want to highlight just here at the end?
Yeah, there are two. One is our final Dinner in the Garden series. We are bringing Firewood on Main chef John Murko is actually going to be bringing firewood to the garden. He's got a fabulous five-course wine pairing dinner that we'll be having. People can cozy up in the garden, kind of last taste of fall before the winter starts. That is on September 22nd. Earlier that day, we've got free family yoga. Just ask you to sign up and register for that, but that is free for families. And then I wanted to highlight one other thing, which is that Vessel Kitchen is another really amazing partner. They are doing a 25% off day for, 25% of all proceeds on September 28th are going to go to Summit Community Gardens and Eats. And that's part of a celebration of their anniversary. And we are so grateful to them for doing that. So please go to check out Vessel Kitchen. And then finally, last thing I want to mention is our final La Milpa program. So this is a program partnership with Artes de Mexico in Utah. We're going to be doing the Blessing of the Harvest. We invite everybody in the community to come and experience one of the most beautiful cross-cultural experiences in Park City, where we will be learning from about the indigenous growing practices around sustainability, around culture. It's a gorgeous event. That is free. You can sign up on the website.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with the executive director of the Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Nadel, and their youth education director, Erica Snyder. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you
so much, Connor.
And happy harvest. Swiss Days is a local Labor Day weekend festival in Midway that benefits local and international organizations. KPCW's Amber Johnson has the story of a chance encounter on the other side of the world.
Midway resident Garrett Watts was in a meeting a war zone away in Poltava, Ukraine, when a familiar scene unfolded in front of him.
The people of Ukraine are so loving and so resilient, and they're like, you know, we're so grateful you came out here all this way. We just want to show a video to express our gratitude. So they start playing the video. It's like all in Ukrainian. And so, I don't speak any Ukrainian, and I'm like, okay, this is great. And then one of the pictures on the video is like the backside of Timpanogos. Like, if you've been boating on Deer Creek, it's like that picture. And I was like, what in the world?
In October 2023, the 24-year-old BYU student was an intern for the Utah Aerospace and Defense Association when he was invited to join an international delegation focused on aerospace and defense initiatives. Their mission was to help supply Ukraine with the necessary materials to support their defense and humanitarian efforts. One day, they visited Poltava to inspect power generators installed at a school and hospital. The video highlighted those generators that were crucial for maintaining essential services during frequent power outages caused by drone strikes.
I'm getting kind of emotional about it.
So why? What was emotional to you?
I think it was just kind of one of those small world things. I had by no means gone into thinking my hometown had something to do with what was going on literally half the world away.
The funds to purchase those generators were from Swiss Days, a popular Labor Day weekend festival in Midway. Half of the proceeds go to the Midway Boosters for town beautification and scholarships, and the other half goes to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints' humanitarian fund. According to its website, in 2023, the church engaged in 4,119 humanitarian projects in 191 countries and territories with 6.2 million hours of volunteer work and 1.36 billion in expenditures. Last year, Swiss Days organizers worked with the church and the Utah-based nonprofit August Mission, which has been focused on providing humanitarian aid to Ukraine, to direct the funds to the generator project. David Nielsen is a local church leader who moved to Midway in 1973. He said back then, Swiss Days was a local affair where a dozen teenagers caught a greased pig and climbed a greased pole, followed by a small community gathering. As the event grew, the Boosters sought help from the church for planning and execution. Today, Swiss Days hosts 100,000 attendees and is run almost entirely by thousands of volunteers.
KPCW's Amber Johnson reporting.